a budget is something that needs to be simple. You know, the KISS principle, keep it simple, sweetheart. It's got to be simple. It has to take no more than 2 hours to create and no more than a half hour per week to log the expenses. If it takes more than that, it will be too complicated and it won't get done, and it's of no value at all. A budget can't be something that we make out and then put in the file cabinet. It's got to be used and has to be updated. And every year you have to look at it and see how does God maybe need us to change this budget and this plan. So it has to be a moving budget. As it says in the scripture, we are to plan, but God determines our steps, so we need to be flexible. Long-range plans, then, are for expenses that are more than 1 year out. So retirement and paying off your house and car expenses, you know, you're buying a new car, those are things that are span beyond a year, so those would be long-range plans. Cars, we've talked about before, are a good example. If you're going to spend $10,000 on the next car you buy, and that's going to be in about 3 years when your current car wears out, then you need to be saving $3,333 a year, or else when 3 years comes up, you will not have the $10,000 to buy that next car, and you'll have to go into debt to get it.
Yeah.
If you're in some places, you don't need a car at all, and certainly don't need a brand new. Oh, yeah, and some cars are worth $10,000 now or worth $15,000 later.
Yeah, that's it.
So you have to kind of decide how much it is you want to spend or how much you think you're going to spend, and then purpose to not spend more than that when you get out to buy a new car. Don't say all of a sudden I have $10,000, so now I can buy a $15,000 car and only get a $5,000 loan. But rather purpose for a certain amount. Find out what God's plan is for your life. Maybe the budget you put together can save about $3,000 a year, but not more than that, so you buy about a $9,000 car. Or maybe he'll stretch your current car to 4 or 5 years where you end up with $12,000 or $15,000. So allow God to be in charge. His purpose not to use debt. You won't need to. Typically, we get into it because of trying to live either an indulgent lifestyle or for our wants and desires as opposed to what our needs are. If you're self-employed, if you're on commission sales, something where your income fluctuates, then you need to look across maybe the last history of the last 24 months or 12 months and say, what seems to be a generally acceptable level of income that I've been earning? You know, generally, I always earn about $36,000 a year to $50,000 a year, $35,000 to $50,000. So budget on $3,000 a month. And then when you get a big month, put the extra into the storehouse, into your savings account, so that when you have a bad month, you can draw off of that. Don't budget based on the best months you have. Don't budget based on $50,000 a year income. If that just happens to be your high point, budget on a lower point. Does that make sense? Okay. So a budget is a plan for short-range spending. And the long-term plan, we need to establish future accomplishments, things like college and retirement. Can you have a long-range plan if you don't have a short-range plan? Is that reasonable? Since we're a small group, let's just talk freely. Do you think you can do that?
I think so.
The hard part with it is that if you don't have the short-range plan to make sure you don't go into debt, then it's harder for your long-range goals to work out. Your short-range plan needs to make sure that you can avoid use of debt, or by the time you're 65 years old, you've been using credit, you have debts accumulated, your house isn't paid off, and now all of a sudden these long-term things aren't able to occur because you haven't planned adequately in the short range. So we maintain that you need to, a lot of little plans make up the long-range plan. You need to have some goals to work toward, but you also need to have the planning along the way to make sure you get there. As Proverbs 6:8 says, go to the ant, you sluggard, and consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer, no ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. They did a study one time. They took this ant colony, and they somehow dug it out of the ground and out of a northern state, and they moved it down to Florida. And the ants went ahead and gathered during the summer and stored it for the winter, but then winter didn't come and they didn't need to use all the provisions. So the next year the ants gathered, but they only gathered like half as much, and stored it. And again, they didn't need it because there was no winter. So the following third year, the ants didn't store anything at all during the summer because they didn't need it. So that is kind of a good analogy for us when we're hoarding. How much do we need to save? Well, it depends on what our needs are and are expected to be. The ant saved just enough for what it needed, but it didn't hoard a bunch extra. So we can think about that in our lives. If we have the short-range plan, the long-range plan, we can see how much can be saved. Based on the long-range plan, we can make sure that we're not hoarding in the short range, but we know where we're working toward. So what are some of the steps for long-range planning? We'll be going through these throughout the rest of the session. The husband and wife need to plan together, and again, if you're not married, you need to find some counsel or someone else that you can make a covenant with that you two can work together in this and do the planning. Usually one is committed and the other person isn't in a marriage. And they need to be updated annually, long-range plans. First thing is we need to just purpose to get out of debt, purpose not to use debt, because when you have debt, then you're blocking God's will in your life. At best, you're getting in the way. So get out of all debt. A lot of people can understand getting out of debt on credit cards. Fewer understand getting out of debt on automobiles, but there's still a pretty good number of folks that can see, yeah, maybe not having a car payment is a good idea. But we even maintain you need to get out of debt on your house. You need to get all the way out and not just stop at the car or at the credit cards. There's a chart. That I want to show you. This happens to be at a 9% loan, and it says this came out of the newspaper, if you are to prepay your house mortgage and you just make a little bit of extra payments every month, what is the effect on your overall debt? So if you have a $100,000 mortgage, for instance, just to focus in on that line, and you had a 9% loan in this case, and you make $25 a month payment is all that you add to the payment every time you have it go to the principal, you'll actually save $30,000 and cut 4 years off of your payment schedule by just making $25 a month. If you make $100 a month extra payment, then you all of a sudden can knock 10 years off. You go from a 30-year loan to a 20-year loan. And if you make $200 a month payments, you can cut 15 years off of your loan at 9%. So if you can put $200 a month extra into your house payment, then you can cut 15 years off of the term of the loan.
It goes principal only, right? The principal only.
Yeah, well, you put it against the principal. Now, a lot of people say, well, Neil, I can't put an extra $200 a month into it. You know what kind of expenses I have? Well, the reason we can't is because we have these other expenses that we're going after, typically this indulgent lifestyle. Do you know what the average car payment is across the country? It's $300 a month is the average car payment. So if $200 a month cuts 15 years off, $300 a month, I don't know what that cuts off, but that's some significant years. If we would buy a car with cash, get a used car, or take public transportation, or in some way not have that car payment, we'd be able to put that $300 a month into the house, get that sucker paid off, and be living the plan maybe that God has for our life instead of living in debt and always paying other people.
I refinanced my house. Mm-hmm. 50-year loan at $50,000.
Yeah, a 15-year loan is a good way to go.
6% interest.
Because the difference between a 15-year loan and a 30-year loan is almost nothing on your house payments. But you've cut 15 years off immediately.
I pay about $4 a month.
But then continue with this program and continue to make those extra payments and get it down to 7 years. Because remember in the scripture, nowhere was a loan more than 7 years. So if you want to follow the principles in scripture, that would be a good one to follow and get it paid off in 7 years. The best way to do that is just make a decision that of all new monies that come in, I'm going to put X percent against a house payment. And then allow God. And again, this assumes that first you get out of your credit card debt then you get out of your car debt, and then you get out of the house debt. And maybe that is, maybe you decide to sell some assets or something. That might, if that's what God calls you to do, then that's great. But I'm not telling you to go out and sell your car so you can lower your house payment, so you can get your house paid off early. Although I think there's some merit to that. But you have to do what God calls you to do, not what God calls us to do in our lives. So if all of the new monies that came into your life were able to go to the house payment, and you've got the other stuff paid off, and just purpose that, God, we want to do that. We want to get this paid off immediately, certainly within 7 years, because that's your will. Obviously, if you have $100 new dollars come in, 10% go to tithe, maybe 28% goes to your taxes, so that means about 62% can go to your mortgage. But whatever that is, if you want 50% to go to mortgage payments and the rest to go to tithe, tax, and some money for savings, whatever it is, if you don't have the plan, then any money that you get in is going to be spent on yourself. It's not going to go toward anything. It's not going to go toward God's work. Or it's not going to go toward prepaying stuff if you don't have that long-range goal out there. It takes an average of 7 years to pay off a house if you truly commit all new monies to go toward getting that house paid off. Our experience is that it takes about 7 years and you can get that done. And you can be totally out from under it. And then what do? Then you start putting the money into savings. And a lot of people say, well, Neil, we're putting $100 a month into a long-range retirement plan. And I don't mean 401k matching stuff. I just mean into a savings account of some kind. Mutual fund. We're putting $100 a month into this, and we're not paying anything extra on the house. Is that a good way to do it? Well, we would recommend that you take the $100 a month into the retirement and pay it into the house. Maybe now instead of $800 a month, you're paying $900 a month on the house. And then at the end of getting the house paid off, then make the $900 a month payments into the retirement plan. So get the house paid off early, then continue making that same house payment, so to speak, and put that into the retirement plan. And in the end of a 30-year, 20-year program, whatever it is, if you look at the numbers, you are financially ahead by getting the house paid off first. Because you're paying, what you're getting in interest on the one plan is always less than what you're paying the bank, because that difference is how the bank makes its money. It's always going to charge you more interest than it's going to give you on your earnings. Any thoughts so far? I want to run through a little chart that we call the biggers and the smallers. And in this example, we're using a, I hope this is the right level house. I have a lot of different examples. It always works out the same, no matter what size house you're looking at. Some places we talk about $100,000 homes. If we go to Southern California, we're talking about $400,000 homes. In this particular case, we're going to say the biggers and the smallers, they both maybe went to school together. And these two couples were married and in school, and they became fast friends. And afterwards, they went to work in the same city, and they were looking at houses together. And they both liked this cul-de-sac with a couple of nice homes on it. And the homes were all brand new. And they were going for about $150,000 each. And the biggers went ahead and bought the big home. And the smallers decided, no, they really wanted to follow more of God's principles, and they didn't want to get into a lot of debt. And they went to another neighborhood and bought a little home for $90,000, while the biggers paid $150,000. So they both have a $15,000 down payment, which means the biggers have a $135,000 loan, and the smallers have a $75,000 loan, based on the same down payment. The interest rate in this example is 9%. Now, I know the interest rates right now are a lot less than that. In fact, just read in the paper that they went below 7% for the first time in 25 years. We just updated this chart from 10% to 9% about a year ago, and while the numbers changed, the principle is exactly the same. We still come out ahead. So anyway, the biggers, they did the normal 30-year loan, because that's what people do in this country, is 30-year loans. And the smallers, they went with 7-year loan. Do you know why that was? Well, as we said earlier, nowhere in the Bible was a loan more than 7 years. That was because after 7 years, you had the year of remission every 7 years, and the lender forgave the borrower of the debt. So the smallers went with a smaller house, 7-year loan. Biggers went with a bigger house, 30-year loan, and their payments were about the same. Actually, the smaller's paying more. They're paying $1,200 a month, and the bigger's are paying about $1,100 a month. So they're about $100 off. Now, at the end of 7 years, the smaller's own the home, right? They own it outright because they have a 7-year loan on it. At the end of 7 years, the biggers, of course, don't. They keep making payments. So at the end of 7 years, the smallers say, you know, we own the home, this is good, but we still want to live near our friends, the biggers, and it just so happens that that other house that's on that cul-de-sac, another one of them sold or is for sale, and they go over there and they buy it. So after 7 years, they buy on the same neighborhood the biggers are in. Now at this point, that house, the biggers' house, you know, it appreciated, it's worth more. So they're paying $211,000 for it, whereas the biggers originally paid $150,000. But they also have a down payment that's bigger. They have a $116,000 down payment because their $90,000 home is also appreciated. Now for the example, the $90,000 home is appreciating at a smaller rate than the $150,000 home because little homes don't appreciate as well as big homes. So they end up with a $94,000 loan and another 9% loan, and again for 7 more years. So they have a monthly payment of $1,500 a month. Does that make sense so far? So at the end of 14 years, the smallers now own the big home, which is right next to the bigger's house. They now own it. Now the biggers, of course, after 14 years, they're only halfway through their payments. They have 14 years paid and they have 16 more years to pay. Correct? But the smallers now own it. Well, after 30 years, the biggers have paid $391,000 into that house for that $150,000 home. And at the end of 30 years, the smallers for the exact same house have paid $247,000 for it. For the exact same house, right next door. Now, of course, you get some tax savings because you get to deduct the interest on the house from your tax return. So we'll take that into account. The tax savings from the biggers is about $79,000, and the tax savings on the smaller is about $18,000. It's quite a bit less because they aren't paying as much interest, naturally. So the net difference, the biggers have $311,000 for their $150,000 home, and the smallers have $228,000 for their $150,000 home. For a difference in payments of $83,000. And we're going to take it one step further, and then I'll see if you have any questions. At the end of 14 years, the smallers are going to take their $1,500 payments. After 14 years, they're going to continue to pay that $1,500, only they're going to pay it into a savings account so they can get the interest off that savings. So at the end of 14 years, they don't all of a sudden have $1,500 to start spending on vacations. They're going to now put that in for this retirement fund or whatever the long-term savings are. And at 6% interest, they have accumulated $491,000 for that 16 years of those house payments. And then, so you take the $490,000 plus the $82,000 that they spent that was already less, and they have a difference of, $574,000. And that's how we're one generation away from paying cash for houses. By simply following God's principles of 7 years and not getting a loan over 7 years, they're able to have $490,000 from their savings and $83,000 or so that they saved over the payments from here. Now, before I talk about this, does that make sense so far? Following that? Now to be fair, we're going to say maybe the biggers, when the smallers started paying more money after 7 years, and their payments went up $300, right? After 7 years, their payments went up $300 because they bought the home next door. Well, if at that same time, the biggers decide they're going to start socking $300 a month into savings. For the same number of years, they would have $378,000 themselves in savings. Now, in reality, when the smallers move next door and get the bigger house payment, the biggers are not automatically going to start saving that money. The reality is they're probably not going to do that. But if they did save for 16 years, that $300, they would have $378,000. And the net difference then would still be $200,000 more for the smallers than the biggers. And that money right there represents buying the next house, that $491,000. That's where they can go out and buy another house now with cash. So if we would just discipline ourselves to buy a smaller home initially instead of the big one that we want, we have the money. And then we could buy the house for our kids and we could help them be debt-free. Debt inflates the cost of a house. If you think about it, if our houses and the houses in your neighborhoods, and I can go over this with you a little later because you missed that, and it's probably why you came. So I'll show you the chart a little later. Debt inflates the cost of a house. Do you buy that?
What is it?
If you couldn't borrow money to buy a house anymore, okay, the banking system failed or something happened and you just couldn't borrow to buy a house anymore, how much would your house be worth? You know, your $200,000 house wouldn't be worth $200,000 anymore if you weren't able to borrow money to buy it. If there was no money anywhere and you only had to pay cash, how many people would be able to buy your house for $200,000?
Nobody.
Just about nobody. Mm-hmm. That house would now be worth a fraction of that. It might be worth $50,000, might be worth $45,000, $40,000, hard to tell. But it certainly wouldn't be worth $200,000 because people just don't have that kind of money. Maybe it'd be worth $65,000, but it would be a fraction of what they're currently selling for. Any thoughts on the biggers and the smallers before I continue?
Do you think there'll be a trend society for groups of families to go together, two or three, even three families to go together and buy one home?
A trend where two or three families get together to buy a home. I think the hard part of that is how they divide equity and living expenses and things like that. We've seen where a parent or someone might buy into the house and kind of have an equity position in it. Where I don't want to give my kids a loan, so they put in $10,000 and we put in $50,000, and that's $60,000, so they only have to put 50% down, and or something along that line, something where they can still get it paid off in 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we call their sweat equity, and you can work out some arrangement where they can eventually own your piece also. But three different families, unrelated, I would think that would be difficult. You mean like buying a duplex?
Yeah, something like that.
Or a triplex?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't thought of that. Have you seen that?
No, I've thought of it.
Uh-huh.
We're in the selling end of this awkward process right now, trying to sell a home and having trouble finding a buyer who both wants to afford it and can afford it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, then you know what it's like when people say, oh, houses always go up. Well, there's a point where houses quit going up.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you can't find a buyer.
Yeah. Right.
And it takes time.
Right. I think along those kinds of lines because the house does have an apartment in the basement.
Uh-huh.
So there's family number two.
Yeah.
And the upstairs could conceivably be invited for maybe a single person down one end and a family of the other.
Yeah.
So there's three purchasing, the potential of three purchasing groups.
What we see more often is one person buying it than renting out the basement in order to make payments.
Uh-huh.
But it's not, they aren't renting it in order to get it paid off early, they're renting it in order to scratch by the payments on a 30-year loan, and then if the apartment is empty for any period of time, then they go further into a hole.
Yeah.
So what our experience has been, that can be a very, sounds good, but they're using it to stretch themselves and basically getting into a position of surety, which the scripture says don't do, rather than using it to get it paid off early to follow God's principles. They're more using it to bend. One of the questions that people sometimes ask, and y'all didn't, but I'm going to assume that you will think of it later, and we'll just cover it now, is the old interest on the house. You know, people say, well, gee, Neil, what you don't understand is I need the interest on the house because that way I can reduce my tax burden. So this is what I call the we need the interest on the house myth. And for this particular example, we use a family in the 28% tax bracket. So if you are, let's say, first example, you're paying $10,000 a year in interest on your house, which is not a lot of money. That's pretty common. A lot of people do a lot more than that. $10,000 a year in interest. That means that during the course of the year, you've paid the bank $10,000, and the government, you're going to deduct $10,000 on your tax return, which means that you basically get $2,800 paid by the government if you're in the 28% tax bracket, and that's through the tax refund. Make sense? Buy that so far? Which means the total money actually out of pocket is $7,200. You paid in $10,000, got $2,800 back, your out of pocket is $7,200. I can attest, we went in the interest on the house myth. We bought into that. And we had a huge amount of interest to deduct. We had so many tax deductions we didn't need anymore. And when it was all said and done, we still had a lot of money out of pocket. So let's say you have the home debt free. Well, if that's the case, if you're not paying the interest, then you have an extra $10,000 of taxable income, right? You didn't pay the interest, so you now have to pay taxes on that money. So you're going to pay $2,800 to the government for taxes because you could not take the deduction. So your out-of-pocket here is how much? $2,800. Your out-of-pocket here is $7,200. So as you can see, you have $4,400 more dollars in your pocket if you have a debt-free home than if you do by having the interest deduction. Okay? It looks like it's all sinking in.
So far, they have ignored what else you could do with that money.
They have $2,800 to have a debt-free home. Why?
Huh?
Why get paid any money when you have a debt-free home?
If you have a debt-free home, why are you paying money?
Yeah, $2,800. Why?
Because you have this taxable income. Instead of writing $10,000 in interest payments to the bank, which you then deduct on your income tax, instead of that, you have the money without the income tax deduction. So that's taxable income. Okay.
But yeah, if you don't have income.
If you have it, yes, and it's gone, you're not making any payments to the bank, but you do have to pay then taxes on that money.
So do?
Yeah.
Why?
IRS taxes.
Why? You have a debt free.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the house. If you can't take the tax deduction here, then that's income here. I'll go through it again in a minute with you. Any other thoughts?
Well, you know, if you don't have that money tied up in a loan,
yes,
then you can invest it somewhere else.
Yes, this doesn't even take into account that your $10,000 that you didn't pay in taxes can now be earning interest.
Yeah.
Correct. This doesn't even count that. That means that you even have more money in your pocket because if you get even 4% return on this, there's another, $400. So you're up to $4,800 with a 4% return on it. But at a minimum, not if you just, if you put it in a mattress, you'd be this much ahead. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's right. 20 years ago, I was single and they told me, you need some tax deductions. So, but then the tax deductions worked out well there because you could lower your category. But now they've eliminated most of the categories. There's only a couple of categories that doesn't make that much sense anymore.
Yes.
You're working, and then what category it fell into, and they were fairly small increments there.
Yeah. I still have people tell me that. I had a person, this guy and his wife both worked, and they had no kids, so they were what we call dinks, double income, no kid, D-I-N-K. And they couldn't make it on the money they were making. They just weren't making enough. And what he told me, in all honesty, was that they needed to have some kids, and they were looking at getting her pregnant so that they could get some tax deductions, because then they were going to come out ahead. Which is just beyond me. These are two people with college degrees that think that if they can get her pregnant a couple of times and have these people running around, all of a sudden they're going to have more money available. You know, these people have no concept of what it costs to raise kids and the little bit you have on a tax deduction. But people do that. And this is one place where, who tells you this? Well, the bankers tell you this because they want you to get a loan. And the real estate agents tell you this because they want you to get a bigger house and bigger, because then they get more money. So it's all the salesmen telling you this thing. And nobody tells you that, in actuality, you've got more money left over. More money in your pocket. And what are we doing? We're not saying anything too radical here, just God's principles. He never has anything good to say about using debt. Every time he talks about debt, it's in God's word, it's in a negative sense. It's never in a positive sense. And it's always short term, and it's always collateralized. And we tend to have 30-year mortgages, which is not short term, and they aren't collateralized. We're in a position of surety, which is contrary to God's principles. So we're going down the world's view, and we're being sold that bill of goods by the world, by salesmen who make a living off of telling us this. And this is what God's principles are, the debt-free home.
Get back to your biggers and smallers idea, though. You know what? Back in the 70s, in our town, we had residents come there, and they'd be there for 3 years. And inflation was so good that they would buy a house, and 3 years later, sell it for twice as much as they paid for it. They lived there practically for nothing for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
But of course, that inflation isn't that great right now. But
right. And you can't be sure that inflation will continue to be great. And a lot of people bought houses in Houston when inflation was huge and the houses were doubling, and then it crashed.
Yeah.
And then they were walking away from houses and they couldn't do anything about it. And Peoria, Illinois did the same thing, and Seattle did the same thing. And people always will say this, and I'm glad you brought it up. They will say, yeah, but you don't understand. Houses appreciate. It's okay with a house. Houses don't always appreciate. I see this, you may have seen it, in any number of cities. And people end up walking away, or they're out of work and they can't take a job in a city where there is work because they can't sell the house. It is below, I mean, they don't have enough equity in it to cover the expenses of selling it, much less buying a new one. And they're in bondage to that house. But they were told, houses always appreciate, go for it. So all of those are basically the world telling us things, and we're trying to look at a worldview and make financial decisions. And the people around you won't understand. And the people in your business and your friends, your church. We have people in church that don't understand why we don't build on our land yet. But we don't build because we don't have enough down yet. We can't do it within a 7-year period. And if we can't, then we are just following the world's view. And they said, but Neil, don't you understand the interest rates are low? Well, God's interest rates are better. God has great rates. Just rely on Him. And when His timing is right, the money will be there, we will build. So it's just a matter of saying, no, not yet. God has said in our lives, no, not yet, and accepting that. And going on His plan for our lives instead of on the world's plan and the philosophy they follow. This is a real example. These are real numbers that are calculated with a computer and the whole bit. And we've got them. Here's another chart that shows, if you want to look at $200,000 homes versus $120,000 homes on biggers and smallers there, they end up with $655,000 in the bank based on the savings. Not to mention the fact there was another $105,000 difference in payments by buying a little home, followed by another little, followed by the home next door, rather than going for the big home the first time. The numbers work. Whatever interest rate you use, whatever house size you use, the numbers all work. Follow God's principles and the benefits are there, but we don't want to wait. We don't want to buy a smaller home. We want to buy the big, pretty one on the cul-de-sac. And I'm talking from experience. And again, we'll go through that again a little later for you. Any other thoughts about home buying? Any other myths that you've been told about buying homes? Do you see any advantage to paying it off early? We had one chart that said for a $100,000 loan at 10%, no, $100,000 loan, if you make $200 a month payments extra toward the principal, then you'll cut 15 years off your loan. And the average car payment is $300 a month. People would just get rid of the car payment and put that into the house. They'd be able to substantially knock that off.
My real question is, why haven't you got some of those young people out there in your audience here today?
You tell me that. The question was, where are the young people to hear
we've
this?
We've been through it.
We've
bought our home. This is probably just curious interest for us.
Yes.
Those young people have been.
Hopefully they'll listen to it on tape.
We
have to be able to teach our kids, and if we don't know this, we can't teach it. And I've got a handout for this that you can take with you, and you can Xerox it all you want, and we'll even give you our phone number, and you can call us and say, I don't understand something, what about this, is that taken into account, and we'll answer your questions. Try to get the word out. The second step, we've talked about getting out of debt. The second step is to have maximum goals versus minimum goals. This is kind of different for people. I want to have a maximum goal. When do we say, no more, I have enough? When do we say, this is all I need and draw a line? That's the maximum that I need. And then when God blesses you above that amount, then you can use that for Him, for His service. If we don't set a maximum, whether it's $60,000 a year, God, $60,000 a year is all I'll ever need, man, will be able to put the money aside for savings, be able to do this, do that, and all the others. $60,000 is it, and then all of a sudden you get a raise, and you get a promotion, and you get moved to a new city, and all of a sudden you're making $75,000 a year. What do you do with the extra 15?
That's for players.
Huh?
That's for baseball players.
Yeah, and baseball players. But I see it in my business, where people that are making $30,000 a year are all of a sudden making $45,000. What do they do with the extra 15? They're spending it.
Yeah.
And if you don't draw a line and say 60 is it, man, that is it, period. God, anything above that. Now, obviously, that might change in 15 years because of inflation. It becomes 60, it becomes 70. I don't care. But if you draw a line and you say everything above that, you might watch, and God may just bless your socks off. And if all of a sudden you're getting $75,000 a year, are you going to spend it or are you going to funnel it to His kingdom? And if we don't have that line drawn, we will spend it. And if we do have it drawn, we're still tempted to spend it. Well, gee, I'd sure like to have that car, or I'd sure like to take the kids on vacation, I'd sure like to take the grandkids here. Whatever it is, we got to draw the line, or we'll never stop our spending. Yeah?
We're in that next level where we don't know how much it's going to cost for us to die.
Yeah.
How much health care you need.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like the idea of these things, like we put the money to our use now for savings. We're not spending on things. We don't care about things anymore. For savings,
yeah,
that we can turn over to our favorite charities or whatever at the time of our death.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that we not have responsibility to our children or,
yeah,
or the community until we die, and then the excess can be used.
Uh-huh. Yeah, if I'm hearing you right, if you're saying not if it's God's money, but when will it be God's money,
yeah,
that's great. Then you're saying, it's here, but God, when I die, it's all going to you in the will or whatever. So I'm not hoarding. This is a matter of, it is yours. You are going to get it either next month or next year or in 10 years. That's up to you. You know, you bring us home, it's yours. How soon do you need it?
You know, we might use it all because cancer is a thing.
Yeah, that's right. So you're providing for the future. You're not protecting. You're not hoarding it for your kids to have as an and which doesn't, I'm not against inheritance. We'll talk about all that stuff on Thursday, about investments, inheritance, and retirement. So if you come back on Thursday, we'll go through this in detail. But yeah, then it's not a matter of if it's God's, it's a matter of when is it his. That's his problem to choose. If he says, gee, golly, Billy Graham Ministries need this now, if he's in the will, I'm going to take them home. And then they can, that's his choice. He can do that. As opposed to writing a check today to all those ministries.
And then worrying about it.
And then have the worry.
Yeah.
Because worry's not ours. Worry's God's. Worry means you're taking on responsibility for something that's his. His responsibility. And we'll, again, we'll talk more about that on Thursday. Maximum goals. You know, to decide I'm going to spend time with my wife, with my kids, with my church, with my mission work, with my ministry work. This is a ministry. I administer my church. I also have a business of my own. I have neighbors. I have family, you know, wife and daughter and a son. And everyone needs time. And I need a little bit of time for myself, you know, with the Lord and prayer and also some exercise and take care of my basic body functions. So we have a lot of things that we need to balance in our lives. And that is a balancing act. And we need to decide to spend some maximum goals and then allow God to work within our life. It's too easy to re-rationalize or to rationalize reinvesting God's portion. You know, okay, God, when I have $40,000 in the bank for retirement or for college education, $40,000 college education fund, we're going to draw a line, and all of a sudden you have $40,000, and then you say, well, maybe they want to go to bigger school. As soon as I have $50,000, it's okay. It's too easy to rationalize that. So set some goals, and then when he gives you the surplus, ask him, gee, God, that is great. Where do you want that to go? And we know some people that said that they were going to sell a sailboat for a lot of money, actually, big sailboat. He's the president of the company. I've used him a couple of other times as an example on some other tapes. And then he was out of work. All of a sudden he got let go, president of the company. And he was just about, and the sailboat finally sold, and they had to decide, okay, now what do we do? Now do we use money from the sailboat as income? Because we have a pretty expensive lifestyle here. Or what do we do? Well, they had already dedicated that to God, so they went ahead and gave it to God and used it in his ministries as they had promised. But it's hard. It takes a real strong person, strong couple in this case, to be able to be out of work and still use that money that's sitting there for God's kingdom instead of for themselves. I don't know how strong I am. I'm not in that position yet, but we'll find out maybe someday. But it's hard. Another example, get a plan for distributing profits from an investment before they arrive. You know, are you going to reinvest all of it, the interest and the principal, and reinvest it? Or are you going to reinvest part of it? Or how are you going to, what are you going to do with your investments in terms of turning it over when a CD comes due or whatever? Or are you going to funnel all the interest always goes to God's word and the principal always reinvests? How are you going to do that? So think of some plans. It says in 1 Timothy 6, 17 and 18 and 19, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation in the coming age, so they may take hold of the life that is truly life. And in both Luke 18 and Luke 19:26, Jesus says, consider carefully how you listen. Whoever has will be given more. Whoever does not have even what they have, what they thinks he has will be taken from him. So maximum goals is step two. Third step is we need a long-range family plan. Train a child the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't turn from it. Again, car payments is a good example. $300 a month is the average payment. To make that kind of a payment, you probably need to make over $60,000 a year. We have a little chart here that says simply, how much car can you afford to buy? I used to hate showing this because I didn't want people to think I was advocating borrowing to buy a car. But since so many people think this is normal, I've gone ahead and included it anyway. The principle behind this chart is if that you only have one car and that your net spendable income, that means you take your gross income, all your money coming in, you take out tithe, take out tax, because those you have no choice over. Tithe and tax are God's and the government's. Everything else after that, you have to manage. You can be a steward of that. Okay, so far? So tithe and tax are gone, now you have your income, net spendable income, what you can really work with, what you can manage. 15% of that money, no more than 15% is going to go toward transportation needs. And that includes payments, maintenance, insurance, gasoline for driving here and there. No more than 15% is going to go to auto out of all that money that you have to be a manager of. That money has to include savings, investments, everything. Food, clothing, household, rent, all of that. No more than 15% is going to go to auto or transportation. Of that 15%, no more than half is going to go toward payments. Now, if you take that principle, that means 7.5% of what you have to be a manager of might go to car payments. You following that? It's pretty hard, but that means that if you're paying $100 a month in car payments, then you need to be making $21,000 a year. And if you're making $21,000 a year, you take out tithe, take out tax, 15% of the 21 of what's left over is going to go toward transportation, and half of that could go toward payments. That'd be $100 a month. I want to skip down here to the end. Since the average payment is $300 a month, that means that you would have to be making $63,000 a year to make a $300 a month house car payment. Now, since the average car payment is $300 a month, how many do you think the average salary for those people is $63,000 a year? Certainly not. Certainly not. So people are indulging. They have an indulgent lifestyle, and they are indulging in automobiles, and they're indulging in houses, and then they want to know why they can't pay their bills. They want to know why they're stressing their marriage. They want to know why they're not saving for retirement, for future expenses. They want to know why they can't do contributions above and beyond the tithe. You know, the tithes and offerings, we talked about that a little bit last week. We'll talk about that more later on this week. The tithe, of course, is not the goal. The tithe means literally 10%, one-tenth. And that's not the goal. That's the minimum that God ever talks about in His Word. Offerings are everything above that. We need a long-range living plan. We need to balance between needs, wants, and desires, and indulgences. Transportation is a great example. We are a society that's mobile, and we need transportation, but that can be walking, bicycles, buses, carpools, vanpools, used cars, any number of alternatives at a need level. We need transportation. We want, wants are quality choices, like steak versus hamburger. I want a new car versus a used car, or I want a used car versus riding a bus. And I know people that that's a big want. I want to be able to quit riding a bus and have a car for our family, one car. And then we desire two cars, or we desire two new cars, maybe. And then you get to indulgences. Indulgences are those things that are even beyond that. They have little or no utility. Usually pride is involved, and debt is involved, typically. And that might be like, I want a new Benz or BMW. So needs, wants, and desires. We need to have that plan ahead. What are we going to do for college? What are we going to do for cars? Are we going to purpose not to use debt for college? Maybe that means you have to go to a community college for a couple of years before they go to the university to finish up. Are we going to purpose not to use debt on cars? You know, the cars that are 2 years old that are being sold in the newspaper, those aren't junkers. They're typically being sold because people have to get something newer and better. And they've depreciated a huge amount for the cost that you're paying. So look at a 2 or 3 year old car, have a mechanic look at it, check it out. A lot of these things we've covered already through our discussion. Family savings plan, step 5. Spend less than you make and save the rest. It's easy, right? How do you save money? Spend less than you make. Put the rest in the bank. Family inheritance plan. And we'll talk more about that later. When do you give to the kids and how much? Or to anybody else, not just the kids. A long-range earning plan. Now, seek God's wisdom. It says in Proverbs 8, 18 to 21, with wisdom are riches and honor, enduring wealth and prosperity. My fruit is fine, is finer, better than fine gold. What I yield surpasses choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness along the paths of justice, bestowing wealth on those who love me and make their treasuries full, God says. And then Proverbs 11, 2, when pride comes, there comes disgrace, but with humility comes wisdom. And a lot more Psalms and Proverbs and around that line. And then we need a contingency plan. And again, that gets into investments. We can't protect against the future. We can only provide for the future. The only protection comes from Christ and God. That's the only place our protection can rely on. We can provide, like a burial, have enough money around to be able to bury us, it says in Ecclesiastes. And it also says diversify. I'll throw that in real quick in case someone doesn't listen to a later tape. Ecclesiastes 11:2, divide your portion into 7 or even 8, for you do not know what misfortune will come upon the earth. So diversify. Have some set aside for the future. Are you protecting or providing? If it's a matter of when God gets it, not if God gets it, then you're providing for the future. But it's all God's. If you're holding on to it so that nothing can happen to you, and you're relying on your money instead of on God, then it's protection. That's wrong. So I think you have a good plan from the little you told me. So we need to modify our plans regularly. We need to accept God's withholding and discipline. Proverbs 12:1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. And we need to be proactive. We need to think about these things in the future based on God's principles now, not wait until they come and then try to decide what to do about it. Because we'll always want to spend it on ourselves. It's awfully hard not to. We need to be honest, as it says in Romans 13, 7 and 8. Give everyone what you owe him. Let no debt remain outstanding. There's a case study I want to do real quick. I think we have time for. There's actually two of them. One came with short-range planning, and one came with long-range. I don't think these will be difficult to run through. First one. Elmer moved from job to job before settling down in his present job, where he's been for the last 18 years. He admits at times he's been lax with his job responsibilities, and he's harboring a little resentment toward his boss and feels like others have gotten promotions he should have gotten. But that's not the reason Elmer came to see him. According to Elmer, he's not making enough to live on. It's about $25,000 a year, and he doesn't expect any great raises. He doesn't think they can do anything about their finances, but his wife is concerned and believes they need to do something. They're several months behind on a few of their bills, so they're in debt. But in the past, the Lord has always supplied their needs, and they have no savings. Elmer is 50, has a small retirement pension with his company. The company program matches employee contributions toward retirement, but Elmer wasn't interested, and besides, he didn't have anything extra to put into the program. He has 3 teenagers, and he's always felt they could make it the same way he did. Elmer and his wife are active church members and give some money to the church each week, but debts have prevented them from tithing. Elmer thinks the answer is for their immediate problems is to get a second mortgage on the home. But his wife doesn't have any peace about this. You know what we call a second mortgage now, because that has kind of a negative connotation. We now call it a home equity loan, but it's the same thing. So what is the present attitude toward planning? How would you describe his present attitude toward planning?
The ostrich plan.
The ostrich, yeah.
That's what he's planning, what he's using.
Yeah. Using a biblical word, we'll say slothful. And that the root problem exists when there's little or no planning is slothfulness. Elmer shouldn't tithe while he still owes debts. True or false?
False.
That's correct. It is false. We tithe, I mean, because everything we have belongs to God. It's only a representation of that all that we have is God's, and here's 10%. You wouldn't want to write the IRS and say, well, I'm in debt, so I'm not going to pay you any taxes, right? Why is that? That's because you fear the IRS, right? Well, how much more so, it says in the Bible, that you should have the fear of the Lord. And what attitude might hinder proper planning? What attitudes might have hindered his proper planning?
Fear.
Fear in his case? I don't think he's fearful. I think slothful is better than fearful, but...
I don't think he's afraid.
I'm sorry?
You don't think he's afraid that there's no solution to his problem?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he might be a little bit of that. I think laziness.
Sloppy.
Certainly sloppiness. Yeah, it might be fearful. He's afraid to look at it. I see what you mean now.
Kind of dumb. You know what everybody's yeah. doing and not paying attention.
I think kind of dumb fits in there, too. And then here's the other case study. Gary doesn't believe in insurance because he feels it reflects a lack of trust. Gary's wife, Sue, doesn't agree, and they've come to you for counsel. Gary says there's no reference to insurance in God's Word, therefore a Christian shouldn't have any. God said he would provide even for the birds of the field. Gary also doesn't believe in health insurance or auto insurance and refuses to carry any. He doesn't have any personal savings and in fact gives away any surplus each month. They owe several Christian doctors money and Gary says they're trusting God for a miraculous way to pay them as a testimony to other people. First we'll ask you, then we'll ask the Christian doctors that aren't getting paid what they think of this case study. Is Gary right about insurance being non-scriptural? Yes or no? Is insurance non-scriptural?
No. I don't think it is. I don't know.
Yeah,
it isn't.
Yeah.
Put in the scripture that explicitly, but it can't be non-scriptural.
Correct. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't say the word insurance in the scripture, but it does talk about provision for the future. And in fact, it talks in Ecclesiastes 6:3 that you should be able to provide for a future burial, for a proper burial. So we are to provide, so you need to have something like for your kids for insurance. We have a policy on both kids, a burial policy, just to be able to take care of that if that's needed. And for my wife, she has a small amount of life insurance on her because she works at home. But the insurance there would be not only for burial, but also to help with any extra expenses with taking care of the kids, being a single parent. So not enough that I can quit work, but in fact, on my insurance, it's not enough for her to never work, but it is enough to take care of her retraining needs until she can get back up to speed and get back into the job market. So provision, not protection, is called for in the scripture. What principle would you direct them to? We talked around this. In 1 Timothy 5:8, it says we need to provide for our immediate family and our relatives. And he is not providing for his immediate family and his relatives. I mean, one trip to the emergency room and you could wipe out everything. In fact, he doesn't have any savings anyway to wipe out. But then the house is gone. It's not a second mortgage. It's just gone. And you also need to be able to pay people. And he's not paying people. Is Sue being disobedient to Gary? Was Sue being disobedient?
Well, I say she's trying to persuade him mm-hmm. to take a different course.
Yeah. Oftentimes, one person gets so caught up in some deal, whatever it happens to be, that they lose sight of everything else around them. And the only way God can get to you is to take away that peace on the inside. If you won't even listen to that, then maybe he goes to the spouse and he takes away the peace from that person to try to get that communication going. So no, she's certainly within scriptural responsibility to bring this up and to get counsel. So if he won't listen to maybe the scriptural counsel and he won't listen to her counsel, then she's going to someone else for counsel. bringing him along. What would your counsel to Gary be?
His savings plan.
But certainly, get a savings plan, pay your bills, certainly.
Pay bills first.
We need to do both, or else, if you don't set aside, while you're paying your debt, and while you're tithing, you still need to set a little bit aside for savings, or else when the car does break down, you won't have anything there to pay for it. And you slap the Visa out again, and then you're further in debt. So you need to put a little aside there.